This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everybody. Good evening, rather. I know it's a false sense of comfort, but I still like it when it actually is cold during the winter. So we're continuing with the Eightfold Path study, and so tonight we're going to focus on right effort. And so here we enter into the last part of the Eightfold Path in which we're dealing with concentration, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, or samadhi. And remember that the sila, samadhi, and prajna are the three essential aspects of Buddha Dharma, of training, of practice. And so right understanding and right thought are in the aspect of prajna, right thought, speech, action, and livelihood are under the category of the sila, or the how we conduct ourselves. And then these last three, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, are the aspect of concentration and samadhi. And so right concentration develops out of effort and mindfulness. And we've talked about how these other aspects all relate directly to that in terms of how we're our understanding, our thoughts and our aspiration, how we're actually conducting ourselves, speaking, acting, and the karma that creates, and the effect that that has on ourselves and others, how the effect that that has on our mind and our emotions and our stability, how it either can have a calming effect or an agitating effect. That when we're living in such a way that we're at ease and not creating, doing things that cause regret and remorse, that has a direct influence on our state of mind. And so effort or energy, and it's, we should think of it both ways, because both of those words in English have some different meanings, and they're related, but they also relate a little bit differently in terms of how we think of them in terms of practice. And so this is the aspect of virya, which shows up in different lists. It's one of the paramitas, the practices of the bodhisattva. And there we talk about it as a joyful enthusiasm, a joyful effort. It's spoken of as a kind of antidote to our tendency towards laziness, sluggishness, apathy, that kind of dull spectrum of our conditioned nature, which is just a kind of deadening within our lives, but is also very much makes practice very difficult, right? Because practice is really, awakening in every sense. And so it's really bringing forth that great aliveness, ki, the spirit of a joyful enthusiasm. And so it is, in that way, helps us to work with and guard against and sort of help to remedy our discouragement, our tendency to get discouraged. It is part of our, gives us the energy to actually fulfill, follow through and fulfill. You know, anybody can practice for a moment or a day or a month. As you sustain it longer and longer, it becomes more and more challenging, right? the more we actually engage it on every level, the more we have to draw upon our capacity to do that. And it's also part of Vidya is, which I think is particularly relevant today, is not being satisfied with lesser joys. It's not being easily satisfied with all of the easy pleasures that we are, so many of us are, have available to us. And it's being able to partake of those and enjoy them for what they are, if they're skillful, pleasurable, healthy, but not to be seduced by them and recognize that there is a much deeper joy and satisfaction that's available to us. When you look at it just as energy, effort is just energy, then it's just, it's one of the mental factors, and it really is just energy. And so in that way, it can be, we can use it and do use it in all kinds of ways. And so we can use it to confine, constrict, dampen, discourage, in all kinds of ways that are binding, but we can use that exact same energy in very different ways. And that's such a, I mean, in a sense, we could think of the whole path as a sort of a discovery, a sort of examination and a discovery of the sort of turning towards or tapping into the essential sort of energetic force that exists in the universe, in every living thing, and exists within us, and how to discover that, meet that really, and begin to understand it and work with it. And so, as I've talked about before, that, you know, one of the aspects of training and why it needs to be, have some challenge to it, it needs to be challenging in different ways, physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. Part of that is just because of our delusion that it is, the path is sort of intrinsically challenging because we're so ensconced in a very particular universe that is what we call samsara, that is, has such you know, logic and power and depth and history to it that it's hard to break out of that. But another reason that training needs to be challenging is so that we can come up against all of the ways in which that intrinsic energy, effort that is within us, that is our aliveness, that we can bring that forth. And the way we do that is by encountering all the ways in which that's limited. So in all of those moments when we feel limited emotionally, mentally, physically, energetically, in terms of our enthusiasm, in terms of our spirit, in terms of our aspiration, all of those moments when we feel confined, and we experience that within our bodies and minds, right? And we usually experience that as some kind of discomfort. And we're sort of at the edge of what we feel like is our capacity. And so in that way, training needs to, in a sense, needs to bring us to those edges, which actually isn't that hard. It's really not hard at all. But to do that in a skillful way so that we're brought to those challenges, and in a way, it's kind of interesting if you think of how of a sangha practicing together where you've got people who are brand new and experiencing everything in the beginning, and then practicing side by side, same schedule, along people who have been practicing for much longer. And how, in a sense, all of us need to be experiencing, continue to be challenged, and at the same time need to be living together and practicing together in a way that is both challenges but also is doesn't ask more than we're capable of. And that's with different people at different levels of capacity, which is kind of an interesting thing. And so that's really how the training is established, is to try and to meet that, kind of find that balance. So I just wanted to take some passages from the books that we've been reading, just to bring their voices into it, because also that'll bring us to some of the Buddha's original teachings, and then open it up for questions. And one of the things, this has come up during the time we've been studying this, and sort of with each mondo, people bring this to my attention in different ways. You know, to bear in mind that these texts that we've been studying are written by Theravadin teachers. So they're really speaking from that tradition, right? Which the Mahayana tradition developed from, grew out of, but also developed its other ways, under ways of understanding and then practicing based on that understanding. And so some of the questions that some of you are having has to do with some of the language and the sense of how the teachings are being presented, which can seem a little different in a sense in some of the ways that the teachings that we're accustomed to are. And that's part of our training, part of our education, is to sort of become, you know, a little bit conversant with the language and the teaching styles and sort of views of some of these different traditions within this one Dharma path, but that do have some differences. And so that when you encounter in your own training, in your own study, some of these different teachings, you have a sense of how to work with that. Like, where is that coming from? Historically, in terms of the Dharma, how do you as a practitioner of the Mahayana tradition understand that? How do you sort of, so that it still has value, right, and can still help you and not confuse you? So that'll come up a little bit tonight. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, he's talking about right effort as being involved as a wholesome form of energy, but it's something more specifically. He says the energy in wholesome states of consciousness directed to the liberation from suffering. So it's not just, you know, energy is energy's sake. And again, energy is also just a word, right, that we're using to describe something which in its essence is ineffable and is not like is like everything else, impermanent, right? Has no fixed nature, no intrinsic quality. So we're talking, using that word as a convention to talk about something. He says, time and again, the Buddha has stressed the need for effort, for diligence, for exertion, and for unflagging perseverance. Right? Dada Roshi used to use the analogy a lot of boiling a pot of water, that you have to have sustained heat, right, and of a certain degree to bring it to boil, right? So you can apply a little bit of heat and sustain that, but it's never going to boil, right? Because it's not enough heat. And at the same time, you can have a lot of heat, but if it's just a burst, it's also not going to bring it to a boil, right? So it's sufficient heat that is sustained. He says, the reason why effort is so crucial is that each person has to work out their own liberation. The Buddha does what he can by pointing out the path to liberation. The rest involves each of us putting this path into practice. And that demands energy. That requires our effort, our engagement. For me, when I first encountered Buddhism, I didn't have the language or understanding, but I can now recognize that one of the things that was so important to me was that I knew that whatever path I took, if I found one that I could trust, was going to require exactly that. I was going to have to do something. It's going to have to require my effort. It wasn't going to do something to me, right? Even knowing the little that I did, which was not much, I knew, I had no faith that I was looking for or going to find something that was going to save me, Piyadasi says, in a similar vein, he says, the Buddha was very emphatic about this factor of the path, right effort, because it was not in his power to liberate people. He was not a savior, and he could give no guarantee that he could save others from the bondage of samsara and repeated existence. But he was ever ready to guide them, to guide us on this path, to encourage us and give us moral support. And so echoing that fact, that truth. Dogen, I was thinking of the four methods of the Bodhisattva teaching by Dogen, and on teaching on a teaching of the Bodhisattva path, where he talks about one of the aspects of the methods of the Bodhisattva as beneficial action. And so I was thinking of this as a way of looking at right effort. Dogen said, beneficial action is skillfully to benefit with your effort, with your energy, all classes of sentient beings. That is to care about their distant and near future and to help them by using skillful means. He says, deluded people think that if we help others first, that our own benefit will be lost. Like if I put energy into serving others, then I won't be developing myself or bringing myself along the path. Dogen says, but this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of unity. It benefits the self and others at the same time. And then he talks about different examples of people who were present or actualizing that beneficial action. He says, thus we should benefit or bring forth our effort or energy in such a way that brings benefit to friends and enemies equally, benefits self and others alike. If you have this heart, then your beneficial action or your effort, even for the sake of grass, trees, wind, and water, will be spontaneous and unremitting. And this being so, make a wholehearted effort to enlighten the deluded, which includes ourselves. It's kind of nice. He speaks about it in a slightly different way.
What is that from?
The four methods of the Bodhisattva. So it's from the Shobogenzo. So I was thinking of the how the path evolves for us within our tradition, within the Mahayana tradition. Has been particularly relevant to effort for reasons that I think will become clear. And so, and I've talked about this before, this basic Buddhist teaching, but that in the beginning we, we're starting where we are, so we regard ourself and our thoughts and our emotions and what we experience and everything outside of us as permanent and real and separate. And so right effort then, how we practice our energy and our effort is coming from that place, right? And this will become relevant in a moment. As we continue and we begin to see and realize more and more the emptiness of things, of self and other, and everything, every phenomenal object internally and externally, then that has a transformative effect on right effort and our sense of energy. In a way, you can think of delusion and everything we encounter that's binding as a kind of bound or entangled or unliberated expression of energy. Right? And you think of attachment, and attachment is just a kind of caught, stuck form of energy. Tension as a form of energy that's just not moving, right? It's held, it's stuck in a particular kind of way. And so when we begin to realize things in their true nature, not only does that begin to liberate effort and energy, but our development of right effort and our exploration of things as having key, as having energy, is what allows us to see into its true nature. So they're just two aspects of the same thing. And this is what so much of the struggle of practice is, you know. And I think that's why looking at it as energy is helpful, because, you know, I mean, just think of, you know, Zazen and Sesshin, you know, and the different states of energy that you experience, tiredness and dullness and agitation and just all of the movements, the ups and downs of that. And then as we continue then to realize as unified that which we originally understood to be real and separate and self-existing, and that what we have come to realize is empty and liberated from the beginning, and now realize those two as one. And that again has a transformative impact on how we experience and understand both effort and energy. And I think of that when, you know, when you read about masters who, you know, had all of these amazing spiritual powers, you know, who could sort of pass through solid objects, or who could, you know, move through space and time. And to us, that can just sound like a lot of woo-woo, you know. Is it? I mean, for somebody who has that depth of understanding and realization experientially about the non-fixed nature of things, what does that open up in terms of how we experience this world? So the basic definition, if you will, of right effort is that the Buddha spoke about over and over and over again, and is really how it's important for us to understand it, is that it has to do with wholesome and unwholesome, or skillful and unskillful states, mind, emotion, thought, physicality, action. And so right effort is to prevent or avoid the arising of states that are not skillful, abandoning those unskillful states once they have arisen, and then at the same time to be developing, bringing forth skillful or wholesome states that have not yet appeared, and then once they appear, to sustain and strengthen them. So in that way, we're working simultaneously on what you might think of as both sides of this, if you will. That which is not helpful, and releasing those, and bringing forth what is helpful. And so let me read a little bit about how the Buddha spoke about this directly. And this is where we get into some of this language that needs to be understood carefully. So there's Piyadasi quotes a sutra in which a Brahmin has come to the Buddha talking about how Brahmins control their senses. And he talks about how they do that, that one should not see material form with their eye, nor should they hear sounds with their ear, and that's how they gain control of their senses. And the Buddha says, well, in that case, then blind and deaf people would basically have control of their senses, which, of course, is not necessarily true. And by control of the senses means, in a sense, the embodiment of right effort, that they're able to have calmed and sort of liberated themselves from all those states that are not helpful, and be able to bring forth and abide within helpful states. And so the Brahmin had no response. And so the Buddha then talks about how he teaches. And he said, a student seeing form with the eye, seeing an object with the eye, there arises liking and disliking, both liking and disliking. And so the student recognizes within themselves, arisen within me is liking and disliking, both liking and disliking. This is conditioned, right? This doesn't exist intrinsically. This is a result of my conditioned mind. It is gross, that is, that it exists on this sort of tangible level. You might think of that as having a sense of solidity, and which is where we get caught up in sort of the appearances of how things appear to us. And he says, and it is causally dependent. It's arising because of karma. But whatever equanimity there is within that student, whatever ability they have within their mind to meet those likes and dislikes without grasping, without getting entangled, seduced, fooled by that, those likes and dislikes, they will experience it as peaceful and sublime. So they will not be agitated, they won't be caught up in it, and sublime here means they'll be able to see it more deeply, not get just caught up in its sort of gross aspects. Now, let me go right to the jugular here, so we can get that out. So then the question is, how do we practice this? How do we, using this language, prevent unwholesome, unskillful states from rising? And these states are basically referring to the kleshas, to the afflictions. So greed, anger, all states of grasping. Think of greed as a whole spectrum, everything within the realm of wanting, right? And then anger or ill will is all, the whole range of everything within, resistance, impatience, irritation, frustration, harsh judgment, non-acceptance, anger, hatred, and so on. Pride, jealousy, states of agitation, lethargy, indifference, doubt, states of doubt in which we have very little faith. So these are the different states that right effort is directly working with. Okay, so these states that we're trying to develop the capacity to not bring forth, and then when they have come forth, that we're becoming more and more skillful at being able to release them, calm them, not let them become so powerful, right? Those are those states we're talking about. And then if you just flip them, what are the other sides of those states? That's what we're trying to cultivate. And so within the preventing, we need to think about that in terms of what are the internal conditions that make our mind and our being fertile ground for anger, for greed, for pride and jealousy, for doubt. Because remember, everything is causal. Everything is arising out of previous actions, states of mind, thoughts, words, actions. And so what are those internal conditions that foster that, right? So that should be important to us because we want to make that ground fertile for other states, right? Not those states that we struggle with so much. That's what we're trying to free ourselves from. So an important part of practice is seeing over and over again what are those conditions, those internal conditions that are making these states arise, right? And then we should also think of it in terms of external conditions, right? So sometimes people are practicing very diligently internally, but not so much externally. it's as though I'm going to be a really diligent student when I do my zazen and when I'm trying to be mindful, but I'm going to keep doing everything that I have always wanted to do that's creating a lot of chaos, right? So that's just not really going to work very well. And so if we think of those in terms of that aspect of right effort, of trying not to create conditions that are nurturing, nourishing, very likely, inevitable, really, to bring those forward. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, to restrain, so one sense of how to work with this is to restrain our senses. So when the Buddha was talking about controlling the senses, One way of working with those things that are so binding is to restrain the senses. And here, what does that mean? So Bhikkhu Bodhi says it requires that mindfulness and clear understanding be applied to the encounter within that sense field. Right? So it's a very particular way of meeting things. Right? Restraint doesn't mean putting yourself in a straitjacket. It's much more meticulous. It's much more alive. It requires much more, actually. It requires mindfulness and a clear understanding of what we're actually encountering. And then once arisen, to abandon those states. And so how do we do that? And so Bhikkhu Bodhi and Piyadasi both quoted or are referring to the same teaching that the Buddha offered on many occasions. And I think that it's important to look at this because it's important to understand this well. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the Buddha in various teachings has offered five techniques, five meditation practices basically for freeing yourself of distracting thoughts. And thoughts here can mean whatever you're experiencing internally. He said the first is to expel, and I'm going to use his language, okay? And remember, he's again, and Piyadasi also, even more so, I think, is speaking from this Theravada tradition. The first is to expel the defiled thought with a wholesome thought, which is its exact opposite. Okay? So think of skillful means. So you've got something that's got its hook in you, right? And you're hooked in it. And you're trying to release it, but it's you're hooked. And so think of that energy now. There's this energetic thing that's happening between you and this emotion, your mind and this emotion, this thought. Might be a memory, might be an anticipation. And so how do you free that energy, right? Because right now it's not free. And so what are skillful ways that we might do that? And so the Buddha presented very specific kinds of ways to opposites or ways to turn your attention. So Bhikkhu Bodhi says, for desire, a remedy of general application is to meditate on impermanence. So think about what's actually happening. So your mind is in the grips of and focus on something, right? And so what he's saying is consciously shift your attention and contemplate impermanence. So what is that doing in that moment? How is that, other than just shifting your attention to impermanence, what effect does that have? Why does that have an effect on the thing that's gripping you? Just take a shot at it. I mean, just think about how you're actually experiencing that in that moment.
Because this moment becomes all moments. So
what do you mean?
This pain becomes healing from the pain becomes the whole cycle.
Can you say more about that? I'm not sure I'm understanding. What do you mean the whole cycle?
So this too will pass again and again and again.
Right. So it's helping you to bring to mind the fact that this is not permanent.
It's helping me feel it more so than bring it to mind.
Right.
But
and why would that be helpful in such a moment?
Because what I'm thinking isn't helpful.
Well, but how are you experiencing that thing in that moment?
Falsely.
It feels permanent.
Yeah, it feels pretty permanent. Like this feels pretty solid and fixed. It is not moving. I can't drop it. And so while logically, if we thought about it, we know it's not permanent, right, intellectually. But we're not experiencing it on that intellectual level. We're experiencing it in our body, in our being. And our experience of it is that of something that is fixed, right? Because if it wasn't, I'd be able to drop it. And I'm not. And so the way I experience that in this body state and his whole physicalized state is something that is fixed. And so to contemplate impermanence is to bring to mind the truth. And then how does that affect our actual experience of that, right? Because we're bringing a concept into mind in a moment that we're experiencing something that is not conceptual in a certain sense, right? And so, what are we trying to do? It's sort of like trying to, get a wedge in there, in a sense, and sort of open it up a little bit, because it's so tight, it's gotten so confined, so we're trying to open that up a little bit so we can see it, right, more clearly. He says, for desire, in the specific form of sensual lust, so think of lust, the most potent antidote is the contemplation of the unattractive nature of the body. And so this, for contemporary practitioners, is often very troubling, because it seems to be suggesting that we should sort of have self-hatred towards the physical body. And it can kind of click into experiences we may have had just socially or within our families or peers or media, but also within religions, who sort of demonize the body because it's a sexual thing. It's a sexual body. And sexuality is like a problem, right? From many viewers. I mean, look at our society's relationship with sexuality. It's pretty messed up, right? We're freaked out by it and we're obsessed by it, right? And so, what was the Buddha actually doing? Well, first of all, he was, oftentimes speaking to celibate monastics, right? And trying to divest them of their mental preoccupations, right, with sex. And so one way to do that was, and so when we're preoccupied with sex, with a physical body, right, we're envisioning that body in our version of its peak expression, right? That which is attractive to us. Right? That's what the attraction is. And so what happens in the Buddha has very, very detailed sort of guided meditations in this, of sort of dissecting the body in all of its parts, so that we're not just looking at its surface, but we're looking at all of the pieces of it, all of the liquids of it, right? All of the pusses and the shit and the saliva, and then looking at it as it gets older and older and starts to come apart and then dies and decomposes. And so it's a practice that hasn't really caught on in the West. and that may be for good reasons, because it can... particularly if you think of the Buddha talking to his male monks and teaching this, where generally, certainly in the teachings, the object that the men are visualizing is a female form. And then that happened within a patriarchal society, and just how that would very easily breed sexism and misogyny, right? And hatred. And the blaming, the long-standing history of blaming, men's blaming of women for their own lust, right? For their own inability or unwillingness to work with their own energy and putting that onto the women. And so there are a lot of reasons why this is very kind of volatile. But I wanted to speak about it just because it's in the literature, it's in the teachings, and it's important to just encounter it, right?
Well, this is a very interesting subject because over the course of a lifetime, we have many bodies. We become many bodies.
Exactly.
And our view of our body changes, because we live so long and we go through so much, and especially for women who change every month during their cycles, that their experience often changes radically in 1 month, every month for years, and through giving birth to being pregnant and so forth. And so that kind of aspect to me feels so intuitive as a view to regard change and impermanence as part of my experience. And in addition, I feel like during Zazen, sometimes the sense of the body shifts radically. The sense of your perceptive sense of your body changes as you're sitting in Zazen. So that's also interesting. And I don't know if that correlates directly with what he's saying beyond the monks being told not to lust.
Yeah, I mean, it is all of the same stuff, which is impermanence, I think. But it's just you're looking at it in a way, kind of more nuanced way, just a moment to moment experience of.
Yeah, I had a question, actually, about before the five techniques, when you're looking at your own effort. Engaging the kind of effort you're making. That, I mean, I remember years ago in early practice, the notion of ceaseless practice was the kind of effort we were supposed to be doing. And to me, I interpreted it so radically wrongly for me, in that I was pushing myself constantly.
Yeah.
And so it took a very long time just even to recognize the quality of the effort, because it was such part of my neurotic nature, I guess. And I think that's really important to gauge or to look at to begin with.
So let me just keep going through this, and then so we can then have the whole thing. So ill will meets its proper remedy in the meditation on loving kindness. So again, if we're in a state of anger or rage or hatred, to shift the attention to loving kindness, and dispelling dullness and drowsiness calls for special effort to arouse energy. And there are several methods: to visualize a brilliant ball of light, to get up and do a period of walking meditation, to reflect on death, to just make a firm determination to continue striving. The Buddha once visited a monastic who was struggling. Actually, it was one of his seniors who was struggling a lot with sleepiness, and he encouraged him to reflect on his good qualities as a way of bringing forth a positive energy. Restlessness and worry are most effectively countered by turning the mind to a simple object, like a concentration practice. It tends to calm it down. So that's the first method. Includes those different sort of antidotes for experiencing and meeting different states of mind. He says the second marshals the forces of shame and moral dread. And again, this is a little tricky. And here he says to reflect on the thought or whatever we're struggling with, and see in it its undesirable consequences, right? In other words, to see in it the aspects of it that are, because there's some kind of attraction, right? Which is why it's so hard to let go of. And so what are the effects of it or the consequences of it that would sort of dissipate or diminish that sense of attraction? The third involves a deliberate diversion of attention when an unwholesome thought arises and clamors to be noticed. Instead of indulging it, one simply shuts it out by redirecting one's attention elsewhere. Okay, as if closing one's eyes or looking away to avoid an unpleasant sight. Come back to that. The fourth method uses the opposite approach. Instead of turning away from the unwanted thought, one confronts it directly as an object, scrutinizes its features, and investigates its source. So here you're looking directly at it and examining it, but from within mindfulness. So that means there has to be enough awareness that you can sit and actually examine it while it still has power, right? So that you can begin to see into it, see its qualities, and it begins to calm and dissipate. And the fifth method, to be used only as a last resort, is suppression. Vigorously restrain the unwholesome thought with the power of the will in a way that a strong person might throw a weaker person to the ground and keep them pinned down with their weight. Okay? So, I'm assuming you can see where some of that could be problematic if sort of understood just literally or... and so I wanted to first just... hang on. Counter that with some other comments that the same authors are making. So Piyadasi says, one need not struggle with evil thoughts when doing mental exercises. It should be natural. If we try to fight our negative thoughts, we won't succeed. Instead, we should note and watch them as they arise, analyze them, try to ease the tension. It's more like swimming. If you don't move your legs, you'll sink. If you whirl about, you're not swimming. If you were like the sleeper, if you struggle with a thought of sleep, you'll never fall off. It only becomes a mental torment. You must not make any effort to sleep. It has to come naturally. So then these techniques that the Buddha is, these methods the Buddha is presenting is essentially how do you move towards a more and more natural state of being and also of releasing, of freeing yourself in moments where it's not natural in a sense, right? Because the energy, the effort that's required or the energy of what we're experiencing is so great, right, that we're struggling to release ourselves from it. And then, let me see if I can find it. I wanted to, Bhikkhu Bodhi also spoke on this, because I just wanted to show how their voices, they're also recognizing, or they're sort of countering the way we might understand those earlier teachings. I'm not finding it. Okay, so let me just let go of that. Yeah. So, so what do we know? So if you think of those five, so again, we're talking about right effort. Right, we're talking about how do you, there's the creating the conditions for things to not arise if they're not skillful and to arise if they are skillful. But then once arisen with those things that are not helpful, that are binding, what do we do? Because that's where we really have to develop some important skillfulness. And so what do we know? We know that the ways that we create suffering are to dwell within the family of suppression, denial, avoidance, denial, all of that. You know, basically, no, this is not happening. I don't accept this. Go away. And on the other side is just spin in it, get lost in it. And so whatever we do, if it's going to be helpful, has to be trying to avoid those two extremes. And so how does that factor in to these different methods, right, that the Buddha taught? And how do we practice us? I mean, you know, how do we teach it and practice it? And so that notion of bringing forth I want to look at his. So that notion of an antidote, I mean, that's not something that so much we teach in our tradition, you know, bringing in a, you know, the opposite of that thing. But you could, if you found that helpful. To think about the moral consequences, or as the Buddha spoke of it, the danger in something, can be very helpful. You know, if you're really caught in something that we're experiencing as just being all good, and it's promising all good, you know, to look at the whole of it. This sense of diverting attention, and then to vigorously suppress it. So the ways in which that can just become outright suppression, or even diverting our attention, can be a way of denying or avoiding something, right? So in studying the self, we need to be encountering and really examining and becoming very familiar with this self and learning how to not be afraid of what we find uncomfortable or what we don't want to be, right? I don't want to see myself as having this thought or having that desire or thinking that way. And so to be able to have the capacity to realize, to not identify with it, it's not me. It's just, it's my mind in this moment. And to be able to experience it in that expansiveness so that it can begin to calm, and so we aren't identifying with it. And so when those arise more and more, they're not hooking us because I am not this. And that then allows us to begin to see more deeply into its real nature. Because as long as we're identifying with it, it's being solidified. Right? Which means we can't see into its nature as being empty. So we need that spaciousness, that stability. But how to do that and ensure that we're not just bypassing. Right? And so this is where I think we have to be just diligent within ourselves and know what our own inclinations are. So if we tend to, you know, employ different forms of denial or avoidance, we've seen that, then we have to be very careful about not doing that, which means really allowing ourselves to, you know, sit in the presence of. Which in a certain sense will be a certain kind of indulgence, right? Because it's there and it's got energy and it's going, and we may slip in and out of awareness of it. But that's better. That's a better path and a surer path towards ultimately letting it go than slipping back into that old pattern of suppression. And there is a time, and I've talked about this, when you see something arise and it's clearly a very strong and old pattern, and it arises again and again and again, and you've really been diligent and you've examined it and you've sat with it and you've seen it come and go, but it still comes and it still comes and it still comes. That's where I have practiced and relate to that last method. And I've never quite thought of it as, you know, throwing it to the ground and pinning it. But my experience has been more enough, and that this needs to stop, right? In this moment, this needs to stop, because in those moments, what I have experienced, what I'm dealing with, is just the energy, right? It's just this energy that's just been so well trained to continue, and that I need to break that cycle. But I need to be very sure that I have been diligent, right? In meeting it over and over again and trying to allow it to more naturally dissipate. And that I've examined it and I'm not trying to hide from it, right? I'm not trying to escape from it. But in this moment, my feeling is I do need some relief at this moment. My mind needs to see that its capacity is greater than this. And so that's the way I've related to that. And tried to be very careful about that, right? Because sometimes if it comes out of frustration and anger, you know, that I'm just, I don't want this anymore, then it can be more suppressive. So it has to come from a more place of understanding, I think. Is that making any sense?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about the practice that Bhikkhu Bodhi speaks of using the senses to meet an object or a situation at the senses and not imputing onto it and, not to allow it to propagate into scattered thoughts or obsessive thoughts or what have you. I'm assuming that he's speaking of this as being, you know, this is a life practice that's happening on and off the cushion. But I certainly would subscribe to it, but it also feels to me as though it's like an antisocial behavior versus a pro-social behavior, because when I'm simply meeting something at the senses and not giving energy to how I might react to it, you know, that includes the way that I am with people.
Mm-hmm.
When a response is not required,
mm-hmm.
let's say, then there's nothing, you know, there's nothing further to externalize. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the way I hear what you're saying and think of that is that, you know, that there is no fixed rule, and that practice and training is learning how to meet things skillfully in this moment, as this, with this mind and this karma. And that, so sometimes to pull back a little, right, which in a sense you could think of as restraining the senses or creating a little bit more distance or space, so that because we might see that we're very susceptible or vulnerable to getting caught in something. And because we can maybe step back, and it's okay to do that, right? Sometimes that comes up with residents, where there's that sense, sometimes people give voice to the senses. Sometimes they feel like they need to step back and have a little solitude, you know, like during a meal. And I say, that's okay. You know, you can do that. It's just, let's just not make a rule of that, you know, because then it becomes another thing. Then it's isolation, you know. But so just to recognize that we can give that to each other, that those, that permission in a sense to move in, and sometimes you move in because you need to, even though you're going to get entangled. But you do that, right? You can give that and practice that to the best of your ability. And other times maybe we can step back because that will slow things down or give us a different perspective or just allow us to sort of work with just this rather than the more complex situation, you know, of relating to each other. And so there's that aspect of just moving kind of back and forth. And then the other is that, you know, all of these ways of working that the Buddha was talking about in the beginning are based on the sense that, as I spoke about earlier, that, you know, this is something and it's happening to me and it's got a force and I am subject to its force and how do I get rid of it? And so because that is how our experience of it and how we view it, these methods are intended to be skillful and at the same time not be overly reifying them further. Right? As we go, and certainly within the Mahayana teaching.
Not reifying the practice, you mean?
the things we're experiencing, the very thing we're trying to let go of, and the one who's letting go, right? But as we're able to see it and experience it, realize it more and more as empty, and that becomes a deeper embodied experience, then entering into those afflictions, whether they're arising within us or whether they're arising within others, is transformed. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, things no longer offend. When things no longer offend, they cease to exist in the old way. They are ceasing to exist as separate, independent, inherently possessing qualities, right? And so, and that also is in flux. And so even with realization, there will continue to be many moments in which our reaction is not based in that realized understanding of emptiness, but is in the older karmic experience of solidity and separateness. That's the way our body is actually reacting. And that's because it's not yet fully realized. It's not yet fully integrated, that's all. And so it's just a continual process, right, or path of that harmonizing. But that's where, you know, the danger of looking at these, you know, wrestling and working with all of these states and experiences within us is that they become more solidified, right? They are the enemy. They are things that we have to, you know, distance or get rid of, extinguish, destroy, and so on. And that's where we started, right? That mentality. And so that's where we have to be very careful. That's why I said, so what do we know? That if we are actively suppressing, then that's coming out of that old view. If we're actively grasping, that's coming out of that old view. And so how do we practice that middle path in a moment when we are not balanced, you know? And that thing, and what we're experiencing has an energy, right, a force that is visceral. You know, it's not intellectual. We might intellectualize it, but it's our experience of it is very, very embodied. That's why it's so hard, right? It's because that embodied experience keeps telling us it exists. It is. It's you. It's me. It's happening, right? We keep experiencing it in that way because of our senses and our physicality. And so that's where realization alone, just having an experience of insight, is not enough, right? That's why we have to practice it. We have to engage each other. We have to enter in even though we're going to get entangled. That's how we work it out. That's how we work ourselves out.
The challenge to all this is large. And it can get, you know, as you say, tense, and that's not necessarily the way to work with it. Where does humor come into this? Because I laugh at myself all the time with the thoughts that we're talking about, especially when they're repeated over and over again. And then my mind comes up with my behavior in the same way that I'm criticizing something else or somebody else. So I end up just laughing at myself. Mm-hmm. Is that any good?
Yeah, I think humor is indispensable, necessary. And, you know, years and years ago, a resident said, you know, why isn't there more humor in Zen or in Buddhism? And there was lots of humor. And everybody was like, really? And so he said, to show you, we'll make a theme, we'll have an ongoing theme on humor. It was kind of a disaster. Was anybody here? This was a long time ago. Yeah. There was even a book. We had some book that also was... So when it becomes self-conscious, it's no longer humor. But I think, you know, to take the Dharma seriously and take ourselves lightly, I mean, to take our life seriously, but take our machinations and the fits we can create for ourselves with some humor, you know, with some lightness, is very important. Because, you know, in those most difficult moments, it's not light, right? It's very heavy, and there's a reason for that. It's because we're in pain. And it's hard, you know, to... I remember in the early years, it was hard to feel, have a sense of humor about myself, right? And I took myself way too seriously. And that was a heavy burden, you know. But it was because I didn't know how to carry that lightly when I felt so heavy and so, you know, bound. Yeah. It just seemed very, very conceptual that I would. It just wasn't coming easily. Fortunately, though, there were people around me who could have a sense of humor about me. Well, yeah. In fact, I remember going over with Dai Roshi, who was still living in the Jizo house, and we were getting ready for Sesshin. And so I was all, you know, in my Sesshin state of mind, and I was a Jishi, and I was going over to pick him up. And so we stood at his altar, which was in the main room there. And so we're standing there, he's facing the altar, and I'm bowing this way. And Asian, his son, is laying on the couch watching TV while we're doing this. And so I'm bowing, you know, Jisha, very serious, you know, Sesshin. And Asian called over and says, "Dad, does that guy ever smile?" And of course, I just wanted to kill him. You know? And Dada just laughed. He didn't answer, he just chuckled. Right? But the answer was clear. So,
Can you return to the point that you were making earlier about energy and ki and seeing into all phenomena as a manifestation of ki, if I understood you correctly? Is that being part of seeing clearly?
Mm. Well, that's what I'd like to really focus on next ongo, in a sense, through the study of the mountains and rivers. But, there's so much there. Let me step back a little bit to, you know, when you to think in terms of sitting, just to focus on that discrete practice. You know, that the way you hold your body, the way you hold your hands, your head, the musculature, right? The way you actually feel your muscles, your gravity, all of that is all energy, right? And it's moving, right? Because that's what energy does. There's nothing fixed about it. And so, it gathers, it collects, it bounds together, and then it releases. With every breath, it's moving. With every thought that arises, it coalesces into that thought. With every emotion, the whole body, in a sense, coalesces, comes together, and it's like a miracle. I mean, think about it. It's like, I mean, we're just matter, you know? Flesh and bones and consciousness, and that what we're calling energy can appear in this moment that has such a particular expression, right? That we call sadness or we call buoyancy, and then it has meaning, right? It has this simple experience. Sensation that is an embodied experience has a history, right? A history in our conscious mind, but also a history karmically in ways that we, you know, take time to understand. It has meaning in terms of what it means about me, that it's like it's a messenger. It's telling me something about me. That's how I perceive it, right? What kind of person am I, right? What is my value? How am I seen? How do I see myself? Which then extends into my relationship with everything. I mean, it's just all of that, right? And yet it's just, in a sense, energy. And that there's nothing fixed, that there is no inherent or intrinsic any of those things that I just talked about in that experience. And yet I experience all of those things in it, right? And that is what we call the self arising. And so to deny it would be foolish, in a sense, because there it is, and also would cut us off from that whole universe of examination. Because what we're trying to do is understand, what does it mean to actually be a human being? Which is that embodied, those embodied experiences, right? That we will continue to have, but will transform, right? And so when the Buddha talked about the factors of enlightenment, rapture, equanimity, right, stability, these are all embodied states, patience. Patience is not just a word, it's an experience of something, right? You experience patience. And so all of that, in a sense, is we could think of as just different manifestations of energy. Just basic wakefulness. And I don't mean in terms of being mindful, but just the energy you feel, of whether you feel sluggish and tired or whether you feel alive, right? And that we think of that as something that also has kind of intrinsic truths, you know, that when I'm sleepy, I'm sleepy. That's just a state that I'm in, right? And so that means I should get some sleep or I should have a cup of coffee. I need to do something with it, right? Because it's uncomfortable or it's limiting in some way. But it's just energy. It's energy that's taking a particular form at that moment that I experience as tiredness, right, or sluggishness. And so I frame it in a particular way, and that has a history, karmically and in my mind, right? I have a certain relationship with that. And so all of that is factoring in and sort of becomes layers upon layers that stand between me and that actual experience, right? And so that's right effort is trying to find our way through, but we have to go, in a sense, through each of those layers, right? Because they, too, have their own nature. We need to realize each of those aspects as having the same nature, as being empty. So we're not afraid of any of those. We don't demonize them. We're not trying to extinguish, right? And in the process of that, all of that energy is being examined and discovered and freed, right? And so when we read about these teachers who are these, you know, highly developed beings who, you know, were able to do, I remember being at a conference years ago in California on the future of the Dharma, and there were quite a number of Hindu teachers and practitioners there, and they were talking about a particular teacher, a woman whose practice, her teaching, was hugging. Some of you may have heard of her. And one of the teachers had talked about being there, and that he said there were thousands of people. And he kind of just, he fell in with a procession and sort of put himself right next to her. He didn't belong there, but he wanted to get as close as he could. And so he managed to find himself right next to her. And he said he sat next to her for hours, hours, as each person came up and she hugged him. And he said he never had experienced anything like that. I mean, think about that. what that would be like. And so, what's that about, right? So that's a particular expression. And so, you know, in the Zen tradition, there's not a lot of, I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, hugging. Now, oh, no, I think there's a fair amount of hugging. But, you know, the Tibetan tradition, there are very particular practices, you know, that talk about working with those energy channels, and I think that goes all the way back. In a sense, I think if we're really paying attention and conscientious and attending to the things we should be attending to, we're working on it, right? So for all that time that I was kind of ignoring my physical body, because I just understood practice as, you know, just realize enlightenment, that's a mental thing, right? So I take this posture, but what's happening here is not so important, right? And so if I'm tense, I just, you know, push against it or just ignore it, basically, until I couldn't do that anymore, right? My body would not allow me to do that anymore, right? Because it was so clearly what was stopping me from developing any further. And so I was not just, I mean, it wasn't like I was completely cut off, but I was not understanding the importance and the integration, the unity of all of this, and therefore not working very skillfully. And so, I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, that was a lot. I'm taking it in. You know, part of my question did have to do with, like, the phenomenal world, so perceiving the phenomena.
Well, if we trust that, I was going to say, if we trust that the world is alive, and we proceed on the basis of that trust, that will help us to be open to that, or even more so, it'll encourage us to want to enter into that. What does that mean? And I think for most of us, probably that works in steps, that there are certain aspects of what we call the phenomenal world that are already alive to us. And we grant that, right? Because we've experienced it. And so it might be, you know, aspects of what we call the natural world. It might be people. I mean, that's where we all experience that. And so here it begins. But I think it's really important, particularly now, for us to keep going, right, and extend that further. And I think even to extend it into things that we may not want to grant as having aliveness, like human-created things, particularly things that might be ugly, right, or harmful in terms of human constructions. Because in their construction, they are given life, right? I mean, they come from what is alive, because they're all based in the earth. But they are given, formed expressly to have some kind of life, right? Which means to be part of our making karma, our creating karma. And so in that way, they have life. But it brings us, I mean, it's really what, you know, the separation of mind and body and spirit and matter and, you know, I think, therefore I am, and sort of reducing the sense of a human being to a machine. I mean, like, that was really a bad moment, right, in history. Right? And then that became such a prevailing belief and sort of a working premise for so much of what we have created, you know, disastrous. And so to reclaim, because we're the ones who become machines, right? And so no wonder we're so in love with them, right? If we see ourselves as machines, then it's just another way of falling in love with ourselves, right? But in that, we die, right? We become dead. And so, and things become dead. And so we treat them like they're dead. And so I think we have to, I mean, I think that's where Zazen in practice is so important and so valuable, because it gives us a way of stopping and turning attention and not just going out and hanging out in nature, which is fine. And many, many people discover that aliveness on their own without any practice per se. But with practice, you know, we can consciously, deliberately bring our attention and trust that slowing down, or trust that stopping, trust that turning towards, and seeing things as more, as not as they are, not as they appear. So, and maybe that all begins with just the different parts of each of us. You know, as we meet all of those aspects within ourselves that we have not, they're there, but we haven't really met them before. And grant them life. So we come again to the end. So a couple of weeks, I think, we do right mindfulness, and then we'll finish up with right concentration before the winter is over. Okay, so thank you, everybody. And who are you pointing at? Joan's going to lead the chanting.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject. J-E-C-T.